The best-known example occurred near Srebrenica in Bosnia in 1995, where Dutch troops were supposed to be providing a safe haven but failed to protect the scared refugees who were massacred. The Dutch seem not to have learned a lesson from this. When Liberia looked worrying in 2004, as it has periodically in recent years, the Dutch sent a naval vessel, but their instructions were, broadly, to sail away if trouble developed. Another revealing case is the ragtag United Nations force in Sierra Leone. In 2000, the RUF rebel movement took 500 of these soldiers hostage and stripped them of their military equipment. Was the RUF such a formidable fighting force? Hardly. Once a few hundred British troops arrived a few months later, willing to take casualties, the whole rebel army rapidly collapsed. The UN troops were an easy target because the RUF understood that they would not resist. They were carrying their guns like tourists, flaunting their jewelry. So much for how not to provide international military intervention. By contrast, the British intervention in Sierra Leone, just mentioned, Operation Palliser, has been a huge success. It has imposed security and maintained it once the RUF was disposed of. The whole operation has been amazingly cheap. I can think of no other way in which peace could have been restored and maintained in Sierra Leone. Uncle Hoefler and I even tried to do a cost-benefit analysis of the operation. Finding out about the costs was surprisingly easy. I simply phoned the Foreign Office, and not only did they more or less know, they more or less told me. The harder part was to estimate the benefits. After all, nothing much had happened in Sierra Leone since the British troops established peace. This, of course, was the point. Without them, there would have been some probability that plenty of very bad things would have happened. That avoided probability is the key to the payoff to British troops. We use our model of conflict to estimate the likely risk of reversion to conflict in Sierra Leone. Admittedly, a pretty crude approximation, because we used the model of a typical post-conflict country, which ignores the particularities of Sierra Leone. But as a way of estimating a representative payoff to post-conflict interventions, sidestepping the particularities is not such a bad thing. We then took this avoided probability of conflict and multiplied it by the typical cost of a civil war, already estimated at around $64 billion. I have to say that I do not like making calculations such as this. Our model is better used to establish which policy interventions might typically work than to estimate risks in any particular case, because there's so much important information about each situation that a model must omit. But for what it's worth, we estimated that the benefits of intervention were around 30 times its cost. With a cost-benefit ratio like that, there is quite a bit of room for error in the calculations before they become misleading. Operation Palliser was brilliant, and the British Army can be proud of its contribution to the development of Sierra Leone. It also serves as a model for military intervention in the bottom billion. Cheap, confident, and sustained. It was welcome, too. The people of the country were truly thankful. Yet it is completely uncelebrated. Instead, reverberating in the newspaper headlines each day is Iraq. As with Somalia, the apparent lesson from Iraq is to never intervene. That is not just the popular reaction, but also the reaction of the insiders. In November 2005, I was invited to Brussels to address a bunch of specialists, and the room was awash with military braid. When I made my pitch on Sierra Leone, the first response was, "But surely that's been blown out of the water by Iraq." The important thing to remember, though, is that we've already discovered what happens when we stick our heads as deep in the sand as they will go. We get Rwanda. So we should intervene, but not necessarily everywhere. Sierra Leone, rather than Iraq, is the likely future of intervention opportunities in the bottom billion countries. Look at the contrasts between the two situations. In Sierra Leone, our forces were invited in by the government and hugely welcomed by the local population. In Sierra Leone, we could not be accused of going in for the oil, as there wasn't any. In Sierra Leone, we did not have to worry about fixing what we broke, for there was not much to break, and we ousted the RUF with minimal damage. In Sierra Leone, we needed less than 1,000 proper soldiers to achieve decisive military change. The differences seem obvious. Protection against coups. It is politically correct to argue that the military forces of the rich countries no longer have a role in the bottom billion countries. Indeed, for fear of arousing anti-colonialist sentiments, the French have got themselves into the odd position of maintaining large military forces in Africa that they dare not use. For example, in 1999, they let the head of the tiny army in Côte d'Ivoire, Robert Gay, mount a successful coup against the legitimate government, despite having 2,000 troops stationed in the country. To keep the French forces in their barracks, the coup leader promised to hold an election within 6 months. And so the French decided to let the coup succeed. After all, it was only for a little while. Evidently, the French government was not aware of the problem of time inconsistency, that sometimes the incentive to break a promise is overwhelming. To be fair, the coup leader did stick to the letter of his promise and held an election. But he put himself forward as a candidate and banned both of the country's most prominent political leaders from running. As you might imagine, this did not produce a happy outcome, and so the French army did eventually have to intervene to prevent a rebel group from seizing the capital. But instead of either putting down the rebellion or forcing a compromise settlement, the French simply held a line separating the government and rebel forces, yielding a de facto partition of the country that has now persisted for several years. Each side has used the respite to rearm. After doing so, the government attacked the French forces, since they saw them as protecting the rebels. The French hesitation to intervene is mirrored in the deployment of the European Union's new Rapid Reaction Force. Ostensibly, this force is for deployment in African emergencies. I suspect that it will never be deployed. For example, it has not been used in Darfur, Sudan, where government-backed militias are currently slaughtering and terrorizing the region's people, nor to put down the August 2005 coup in Mauritania. Its creation allows Europe to present the impression that it is doing something, just as the continuing French military presence in Africa creates the illusion of French power. But in reality, these forces are impotent, because Europe does not have an authorizing environment for their use. The United Nations does, but actually for many bottom billion environments, we can do better. We could turn to the regional political groupings. Most of the costs of state failure accrue to neighbors. That is, state failure is a regional public bad. So it is the region that has the strongest interest to do something about it. But in Africa, no country really has the resources or the political ascendancy to impose order on failing neighbors. So the European Union has the forces and the aspirations, and the affected regions have the interests and can confer legitimacy. This situation has the potential for a marriage. The African Union could provide the political authority for military intervention, and the European Rapid Reaction Force could be the backbone of whatever force was used to intervene. I will give an example of what I have in mind, something that almost worked out well, but didn't. Togo. Togo was ruled as the personal fiefdom of a dictator, Nasingbe Eyadema, for 38 years, a longer continuous period of rule than anywhere else other than Cuba. His rule was economically ruinous, as well as politically stifling. He died in February 2005, and his son, Fora Nasingbe, declared himself president. At this point, the African Union, to its considerable credit, classified the event as a coup and insisted on a constitutional process. The African Union had sufficient power relative to Togo that Nasingbe agreed to elections. Triumph? Nearly. Nasingbe decided not only that he would be a candidate in the elections, but that he would run them. To nobody's great surprise, he announced himself the winner, though had he actually taken the trouble to count the votes, he would have discovered that he had lost. So what should have happened? Well, surely what should have happened is that once the African Union had declared the coup unconstitutional, an international military force should have arrived promptly in the country to take temporary power. It really would not have needed to be a very big force. Speed would have been more important than size. In fact, what was needed was a rapid reaction force, which the European Union already had. A temporary military intervention would have supervised free and fair elections. Nobody could have accused such an intervention of being neo-colonialist, as the international force would not have been trying to colonize Togo. It would have sat there for perhaps 4 months. As it is, the world may have to wait a good long time until Nasingbe makes his own decisive contribution to its development by dying, for he was 38 when he became president. Coups such as the one that destabilized Côte d'Ivoire are still a problem for the bottom billion. Remember, they are driven by much the same factors as rebellions are, poverty and stagnation. And yet it would be relatively easy to make coups history. We just need a credible military guarantee of external intervention. Obviously, the European Union is not going to offer a blank check to every regime in the bottom billion, but we could offer a guarantee to democratic governments conditional upon internationally certified free and fair elections. I will spell out the conditions we might specify in Chapter 10 on international norms. Are domestic militaries a substitute? You might well be prepared to accept that in extreme situations such as Somalia, where there is a total breakdown of authority, there is a need for external intervention. But as for post-conflict situations and the risk of coups, why don't the governments of the bottom billion rely upon their own security forces? Well, because in precisely the situations where governments face the greatest risks, their own military establishments are not the solution, but rather part of the problem. Peace through strength. Back in Chapter 2, I discussed the risk that post-conflict situations might revert to conflict. It's a substantial risk, and post-conflict governments know it. Typically, what they do is to keep their military spending high, almost as high as during the war itself. They forgo the chance of a peace dividend, thinking it too risky. This is a natural reaction, and you can see it on the ground. High levels of domestic military spending are typical in post-conflict situations. But this could just be inertia. I wondered whether it would be possible to test whether governments set their levels of military spending specifically in response to the risk of civil war. Anker and I were already working in the specialized world of military spending in order to determine whether it was financed by aid, as I discussed in Chapter 7. And we had already modeled the risk of civil war, as you saw in Chapter 2. We now brought the two together. Sure enough, the level of military spending that a government chose reflected the risk of civil war that it faced. Post-conflict governments were spending more on the military largely because they faced abnormally high risks. Then we decided to confront the issue of whether this high level of post-conflict military spending was effective in deterring conflict. This was not an easy question to answer, because obviously the governments that spend the most are likely to be those that face the biggest risks. As a result, unless military spending is totally effective, high spending will be correlated with reversion to conflict. In other words, because causality runs from risk to spending, it is hard to distinguish any causality from spending to risk. We think we managed to overcome this problem, and our published results indicate that high military spending in post-conflict situations is part of the problem, not part of the solution. It makes further conflict substantially more likely. It is natural for a post-conflict government to try to defend itself, but it doesn't work. We have an idea of what goes wrong, and it involves time inconsistency. In post-conflict situations, neither side trusts the other. The rebels face the greater problem because governments can maintain their armies during peace much more easily than can the rebels. So although the government has an incentive to promise an inclusive peace deal, as time goes on, it has less and less of an incentive to keep its word. As a result, there are sure to be factions among the rebel forces wanting to go back to war preemptively while the option is still open. High military spending by the government may inadvertently signal to the rebel forces that the government is indeed going to renege on any deal and rule by repression. I was once brought in to talk to a depressingly large group of finance ministers from post-conflict countries, and I put to them this argument that high military spending is likely to be dysfunctional. Despite the fact that military spending is often a taboo subject, there was an enthusiastic chorus of approval, led by the finance minister of Mozambique, Luisa Diogo. Now Prime Minister, Diogo gave us the example of her own country. Completely bucking the usual trend, her government had radically cut military spending to virtually nothing, and the peace had endured. It turned out that, far from favoring big military budgets, finance ministers wanted evidence to defend their spending priorities against the demands of the powerful military lobby. The key implication is that in post-conflict situations, risks are high. Governments recognize these risks. Eventually, if they run the economy well, This will bring the risk down, but it is going to take around a decade. There is no magic political fix, and so there has to be some military force to keep the peace during this dangerous period. But if the force is domestic, it exacerbates the problem. In the typical post-conflict situation, external military force is needed for a long time. Grand extortion. One obvious feature of coups is that they are perpetrated by the military. Our work on coups and on military spending shows pretty straightforwardly that after a successful coup, the new leaders slam up military spending. But Anke and I wondered whether in response to a high risk of a coup, governments tried to buy the military off. If this was the case, the military would, in effect, be running a protection racket on a grand scale. We termed this grand extortion. So we had a clear question. Did a high risk of a coup drive up military budgets? Again, it was not an easy question to answer. Our research, which is still new and as yet unpublished, revealed that behavior was distinctive in the governments of the bottom billion. In countries that are richer than the bottom billion, the risk of a coup is small, and if it increases a little, the military budget is not increased. Indeed, if anything, the military gets cut if it starts to be a nuisance. By contrast, in the countries of the bottom billion, coup risk is generally much higher. The threat from the military is indeed probably the biggest risk of losing power that most of these governments face. And they pay up. More risk induces more money for the military. If, however, we are right, then governments in the bottom billion are in a bind. They are genuinely threatened by their own armies, and so, threatened by grand extortion, they pay up. I say they pay up, but remember from Chapter 7 that in many of the bottom billion countries, around 40% of military spending is inadvertently financed by aid. So actually, we in the West pay up. The militaries of the bottom billion are running an extortion racket, and our aid programs are the victim. Coups are usually a dysfunctional way of changing government, and that is the core reason why we need to provide external military guarantees against them. But we might also bear in mind that if we provided military guarantees, the protection rackets would collapse. Governments could spend our aid on development instead of extortion. Chapter 9. Laws and Charters. So far, I have looked at aid and at military interventions. Both are useful, but both are pretty costly. One in money, and the other in guts. Political guts. And sometimes soldiers' guts. Now I am going to look at a range of interventions that are strikingly cheap. They fall into two groups. Changes in our own laws that would benefit the bottom billion, and the generation of international norms that would help to guide behavior. Our laws, their problems. In Chapter 1, I discussed the danger that the societies of the bottom billion might become safe havens for criminals, terrorists, and disease. Paradoxically, some of this is reciprocal. The rich countries have been a safe haven for the criminals of the bottom billion. One grotesque form of this safe haven role has been that Western banks have taken deposits looted from the bottom billion societies, held the money in great secrecy, and refused to give it back. Many Western countries are incriminated in this shameful practice. In the United States, it came to light in 2004 that Riggs Bank in Washington, D.C., was holding huge deposits from the president of Equatorial Guinea and writing him cringingly effusive letters of encouragement. As soon as the matter came to light, it was stopped, and the bank radically reorganized. In Britain, it was revealed in 2000 that the family of Sani Abacha, a former military dictator of Nigeria, had made massive cash deposits into London banks with no troubling questions whatsoever. But probably the all-time prize goes to Switzerland. Also around 2000, it came out that Abacha had placed money there as well before his death in 1998. When the post-Abacha Nigerian government pursued the money, the Swiss did not exactly cooperate. Even after a Swiss court eventually ruled that the deposits belonged to the government of Nigeria, the Swiss Minister of Justice refused to return the money. He had to be shamed into doing so. Does Switzerland really need to make a living this way? The costs and complexities of getting corrupt money repatriated make the process prohibitive in all but the most dramatic and publicized cases. Is changing this at all feasible? If we made the reporting of any potentially corrupt deposits a requirement of banking, and if we made the freezing and repatriation of those deposits radically easier, would it seriously damage our financial system? I doubt it, because if the money is suspected of having a connection to terrorism, we already do it. The West's current concern is terrorism, so we do something about it. The problem of governance in the bottom billion is not seen as ours, and so we do the minimum. Consequently, corrupt politicians in the bottom billion continue to stack their money away in Western banks. Of course, most bankers are people of integrity, but the banking profession has a responsibility to clean up its act, just as De Beers did in respect to diamonds. At present, a small minority of bankers are living on the profits from holding deposits of corrupt money. We have a word for people who live on the immoral earnings of others: pimps. Pimping bankers are no better than any other sort of pimp. They have to be driven out of banking, and it is primarily the responsibility of the banking profession itself to do it, for it's the bankers who have the inside knowledge, just as the main defense against quacks is the medical profession. The agency with official responsibility for oversight of the financial sector is usually the central bank. Central banks are about as far removed from aid agencies as it is possible to get, while still being agencies within the same government. For example, politically, the staffs of aid agencies are on the far left of government, while central bankers are on the far right. Aid agencies have little choice but to focus on the bottom billion. They are not going to be able to duck the problem. But central bankers will most surely be able to duck it, claiming it has nothing to do with them and that their priorities lie elsewhere. Somehow, the central banks have to get this onto their agenda. It is not just the banks. Until very recently, if a French company bribed a public official in a bottom billion society, the payment was tax deductible. Think it through. French taxpayers were subsidizing bribery. Of course, it did not apply to the same behavior within France. If a French company had reported that it had bribed a French politician, the consequence would have been a criminal investigation, not a reduced tax bill. France was not alone in this practice. No Western government wanted to force its companies to behave properly because there was the reasonable fear that this would disadvantage its companies in winning contracts. The great commercial game in bottom billion societies has been to bribe your way into a lucrative contract. This is an instance of a coordination problem that game theorists call the prisoner's dilemma. We would all be better off in a world in which our companies did not bribe the governments of the bottom billion, but the worst outcome is for the companies in one nation to refrain from bribing while those of other nations continue. And so, for a long time, we are all locked into bribery. Eventually, after a lot of pressure, in 1999, the OECD managed to organize the necessary coordination to escape this dilemma, an agreement among its member governments that they would all legislate to make bribery of a public official in a foreign country an offense. The question is now how vigorously this legislation will be enforced. Again, all the incentives at the corporate and country level are not to cause trouble. At least bribes are no longer tax deductible. But of course, it is very easy to dress up a bribe as a facilitation payment for some service. It is only when whistleblowers within a company have an incentive to report the truth that the law can be properly enforced. Within government, this sort of work comes under the responsibility of the department that deals with trade and industry. These departments see their external role as helping to win exports. It is hard to get them to worry about the impact of their actions on the governance of the bottom billion. Like central banks, they do not see it as their problem. Corruption has its epicenters. I started by focusing on our banks, where much of the loot is deposited. Among the companies that pay the bribes, two sectors seem to stand out: resource extraction and construction. I will discuss how to deal with the problems of resource extraction shortly. It has been publicly recognized as a problem, at least since the launch of the Extractive Industries Transparency Initiative by Britain's Tony Blair in 2002. By contrast, corruption in the construction sector has been a dirty secret. Transparency International decided to bring it to greater prominence by devoting its Global Corruption Report 2005 to the sector. Construction has all the ingredients conducive to corruption. Each project is a one-time-only thing, and so cannot readily be priced. There are so many uncertainties in execution that it is not possible to draw up what economists refer to as a complete contract. As a result, it is easy to evade the discipline that would otherwise be imposed by competitive tendering. A crooked construction company colludes with a public official to win the contract with an artificially low bid, but then they recontract on points of detail that crop up during construction. A friend of mine was finance minister in Eritrea, at the time one of the least corrupt of the bottom billion countries. Even so, he realized that he would not be able to prevent corruption in construction projects, and that this would undermine governance more widely. His drastic solution was to minimize spending on construction, vetoing projects wherever possible. He was not foolish. There are now credible studies for some countries that estimate how much corruption in the construction sector is raising the cost of infrastructure and thereby reducing growth, and these effects are large. Why is corruption in the construction sector particularly important now for the bottom billion? Well, the Glen Eagles G8 summit in July 2005 announced a doubling of aid focused on infrastructure. As this gets implemented, there is going to be a massive construction boom in many of these countries. Under present circumstances, this will amplify what is already a serious problem of misgovernance. Corrupt money is not just a waste. Think back to the natural resource trap. Big, corrupt money is likely to undermine the political process, enabling the strategy of patronage to triumph over honest politics. Aid for infrastructure makes sense, but only if it is matched by a radical tightening of the enforcement of anti-corruption norms and regulations in the construction sector. The construction companies are largely our companies. Their behavior depends upon our laws and how they are enforced. Norms for the bottom billion, making international standards and codes pertinent. Most conduct is guided by norms rather than by laws. Norms are voluntary and are effective because they are enforced by peer pressure. Over the past 50 years, the world has generated a huge range of them, enshrined in international standards and codes. Most of these are voluntary. Others ultimately have the force of law and so curtail national sovereignty, but are largely enforced by peer pressure rather than by legal penalties. Norms can be massively effective in inducing changes in governance. To see how effective, look at Eastern Europe over the past decade. The typical situation was that the countries of Eastern Europe, having escaped from the Soviet bloc, wanted to lock themselves into being market democracies. They had one hugely attractive option to hand, membership in the European Union, called the European Community until 1992. But the EU had an established set of rules, the acquis communautaire, to which all new members had to adhere. Over the course of a decade, the countries of Eastern Europe made a massive effort to change their societies into market democracies in order to meet these standards and so have a chance of becoming members. This was the power of a set of international norms at its most stunning. If you want to understand why some countries of the former Soviet Union have done well while others are becoming failing states, a pretty good guide is geography. The further away from the EU, and so the less credible the prospect of EU membership, the worse they have done. The societies of the bottom billion need some set of norms that are analogous to the EU effect. They do not, however, literally need the acquis communautaire. These rules were written for Western Europe. The countries of the bottom billion need rules that are appropriate for societies at their level of development that address the problems they face. There are lots of standards and codes, but mostly they codify desirable behavior for either the already developed countries or the emerging market economies. The societies of the bottom billion have different problems and need different norms. In this chapter, I'm going to focus on what norms really matter for them. How to get these norms adopted is going to be deferred until part 5. I'm going to propose 5 international charters. Norms that I think would help reformers within the societies of the bottom billion to achieve and sustain change. A Charter for Natural Resource Revenues. In Chapter 3, I set out what goes wrong in resource-rich countries. International standards are our best hope of helping reformers within these societies to put things right, and the payoff would be huge. Resource revenues to the bottom billion are bigger than aid, and far more poorly used. If we could raise the effectiveness of resource revenues even to the present level of aid effectiveness, the impact would be enormous. The British government has already made a start on proposing international standards, launching the Extractive Industries Transparency Initiative in 2002. This is a good start, but only a start. What should a more comprehensive charter say? Let's explore the chain from undiscovered resources in the ground to the basic public services that they could finance. Step one is awarding the contracts to get the resources out of the ground. This step has usually been a disaster. Companies have bribed their way into contracts that are lucrative for them and for the bribed politicians, but lousy for the country. Tufts University economist Maggie McMillan has managed, thanks to the much greater freedom of information in the United States than elsewhere, to get data on the international investment returns of U.S. oil companies. She is finding that their returns have been higher the worse the governance of the countries in which they operate. Of course, the companies will explain this as compensation for risk, and in part it is, but it also probably reflects the returns to the lack of transparent competition. An oil field in a developed country is auctioned off in a transparent process. This should be a basic requirement of an international charter on resource extraction. Since the design of auctions is complicated, and apparently transparent processes can still be corrupt, a charter could usefully spell out some of the key features of an effective process. Step two is what the contracts say. In particular, who bears what risk? At present, price risk is borne by governments, not by companies. Tiny countries, with governments that lack the competence to manage even a village post office, are trying to cope with boom-bust cycles rather than the task being done by the financially sophisticated and huge oil companies at the other end of the contract. It does not have to be like that. Oil companies could bear at least part of the price risk. For example, undertaking to provide a set quantity of oil at the world price averaged over several years, thereby stabilizing a component of total oil revenue. Step three is to make all payments of revenue transparent. This has been the focus of the Extractive Industries Transparency Initiative and of its precursor, the Publish What You Pay campaign. It was the right place to start. Unless citizens know what money is coming in, they have little hope of scrutinizing how it is used. All companies must be included, most especially the national oil companies that are sometimes governments within governments. There is also a need for some honest broker to collate the individual company information into a coherent picture of flows into government. For example, in Angola there are 34 foreign oil companies and a state-owned national oil company. It is a skilled job to make sense of the information supplied by each individual company. The obvious agency to do this would be the World Bank or the IMF, as either of these has the expertise and does not stand to gain from falsification. The broker would act merely as an accountant, not as a police officer, converting a confusing morass of information into knowledge that citizens could use. Step four is transparency in public expenditures. In the resource-rich countries, effective public spending is the vital route to development, and this is not going to happen without transparency. Whereas transparency in public spending is always desirable, in the resource-rich countries, it is vital. And so there is a need to set out minimum standards of transparency. I spell this out below when I discuss the Charter on Budgets. Step five is a set of rules for smoothing public spending in the face of revenue shocks. The history of resource revenue shocks is a pretty sad one. Booms have often been the prelude to crises. Astonishingly, given its core role in crisis management and prevention, the IMF has not yet come up with simple guidelines on how to manage volatility in resource revenues. It is true that perfection is elusive and the details can become complex, but a guideline does not have to be so sophisticated in order to be an improvement on what has gone on in the past. At present, resource-rich countries have to come up with their own ad hoc systems, each different. Often, these are the pet project of some reforming minister and do not survive beyond the minister's departure. An international standard would make smoothing arrangements easier to introduce and harder to remove. It is important to distinguish between smoothing out shocks, which is a medium-term strategy, and accumulating financial assets for future generations. Norway, about the richest country in the world, parks some of its oil revenue in a Future Generations Fund, and several countries of the bottom billion have sought to imitate it. This may be a good idea for Norway, which has capital coming out of its ears, but it is a pretty doubtful one for the bottom billion societies, since they are extremely short of capital. They need to learn how to invest their money well domestically, not how to park it in the US stock market. Future generations funds are even politically risky in low-income countries. As they accumulate, they are a mounting temptation for populism. Consequently, future generations funds are unlikely to make it through to some future generation, and more likely to be a transfer from the prudent governments that establish them to the imprudent governments that dismantle them. Sadly, that is what the record to date bears out. If such a charter were launched, would it have any effect? I first became convinced of the need for a charter when I visited East Timor. The Indonesians had recently pulled out, and the new government had yet to be elected. However, the little group of exiles who had returned from Portugal and who formed the provisional government had decided to hold a planning retreat, since East Timor was about to get seriously large oil and gas revenues. The exiles knew that managing the revenues would be difficult, and to their considerable credit, they knew that they knew nothing, and had done something about it, looking for a model of how to handle the revenues. If there had been a model spelled out in an international charter, most probably they would have adopted it and turned their attention to some of the other thousand things that a post-conflict government has to worry about. But there was no charter. Instead, they used two criteria to find a model, both of which were understandable. The first criterion was that it had to come from a country with oil. It was hard to argue with that one. Criterion number two was that it had to come from a Portuguese-speaking country, so that they could understand it. This also appears to have some logic to it, except that when you put the two criteria together, you come up with Angola. They sent a team to Angola to learn how to manage oil revenues, but they might as well have sent a team to a brothel to learn about sanctity. As it turned out, they had more sense than to use Angola as a model, but unfortunately, they used Norway instead. This episode convinced me that a charter would be useful. And so it has proved. The Extractive Industries Transparency Initiative, which was launched by the British government in 2002 as a proto-charter, has already had an effect. It has been picked up by East Timor and by several West African governments, not least the reform team in Nigeria. I remember attending a meeting of West African ministers at which the governance of oil revenues was discussed. The delegations that were decidedly unenthusiastic about transparency sat there quietly, perhaps hoping to be shielded by an Africa versus the outsiders mentality. It didn't happen. Several of the other African delegations wanted change and committed to transparency. What followed was an intense internal debate within some of the recalcitrant governments on whether or not to commit to the charter. There were evidently some voices within even the worst governments wanting change, just as, unsurprisingly, there were voices wanting the gravy train to continue. Can you imagine that happening without the spur of an international charter? This peer pressure is one way in which international standards might get adopted. As reformers from time to time gain power in bottom billion countries, they seize their moment to adopt the standards, and then it becomes politically troublesome to abandon them. As more countries adopt them, pressure on the non-adopters grows because they begin to stand out as conniving at corruption. The main point of pressure for the adoption of international standards would come from within the bottom billion societies themselves, especially from civil society. An international charter gives people something very concrete to demand. Either the government adopts it, or it must explain why it won't. All societies of the bottom billion have plenty of latent opposition to bad governance. But transforming this latent opposition into effective pressure is difficult. Even at the best of times, such pressure is a public good, and so subject to all the problems of free riding, the "why bother, let's leave it to someone else to stick their neck out" attitude. And of course, in many societies, it requires courage as well as effort. What is more, because reform is complicated, people can reasonably disagree on what needs to be done. But such disagreements divide and dissipate the reformist opposition. Often such disagreements elide into disputes over leadership. Backing someone else's idea for reform is perceived as acknowledging the other as leader and thus giving up one's own claim. Where villains are in power, they should not be underestimated. Not only do they have money, but they are skilled in the tactics of divide and rule. They will be actively trying to create and amplify disagreements. An international standard provides something that all the opposition can coordinate around without conceding leadership to anyone in particular. A third key pressure point in cleaning up resource revenues is the international companies in the extractive industries. The model here is De Beers and its Kimberley process for the certification of diamonds. For many years, De Beers had been in denial that conflict diamonds were a problem. Then pressure from NGOs persuaded the company that denial was not going to work. If the image of conflict diamonds became entrenched in the mind of consumers, diamonds could go the way of fur. To their considerable credit, De Beers radically changed tack. They came up with a plan for certification, and they are still pressing ahead to make this process more effective. For example, they are promoting a new smart card technology that can be used to make it far harder for alluvial diamonds dug up from riverbeds by individual prospectors to be smuggled. As certification becomes more effective, the rents from diamonds can accrue to governments rather than to traders. One expert told me he thought alluvial miners were currently getting only around 10% of the true market price. De Beers demonstrates that big companies can become a key part of the solution rather than being part of the problem. What worked for diamonds may not work for oil, but in one respect, the task of transparency is quite a bit easier. It is far harder to smuggle oil than diamonds. There has been some conflict oil. At one stage, oil worth about $1 billion a year was being bunkered, stolen from the Delta region of Nigeria. But because of the trace elements found in oil, its origin is detectable, and so certification could be effective. Indeed, once the Nigerian government managed to track down where its oil was being sold, it was able to curtail the problem. In another respect, however, the organization of the industry, oil is harder than diamonds. De Beers is far more important to the diamond market than any single oil company is to the oil market. When BP tried to work in a transparent manner in Angola, the Angolan government threatened the other 33 oil companies operating there that the first one to follow would be thrown out. None did. Oil companies are too competitive for the industry to organize itself of its own accord. This is where Western civil society comes in. Brent Spar was an oil well in the North Sea that had reached the end of its productive life. Shell, the owner, proposed to discard it in a way that might have damaged the environment. The reaction by European environmentalists was so devastating to Shell's image and sales that it changed its policy on closing oil wells. At first, the Shell management tried to stand firm, but then sales of Shell products in Germany crashed by 30%, prompting the manager of Shell Germany to break ranks. Where did all this power come from? Well, perhaps it was the accumulated effects of German teenagers in the backseat of the family car saying, "No, Mom and Dad, not that gas station. Did you hear what Shell wants to do?" And the parents presumably thought it was better to avoid the argument. Brent Spar demonstrated that what ordinary people in the West think about oil companies really matters. Those with brand names have spent billions building up their reputation and do not want to see it destroyed. The problem is that at present, the pressure is for things that just do not matter very much for the bottom billion. Companies are being pressured on their environmental policies and on their employment policies, both of which are frankly peripheral, when what is needed is pressure on their policies toward governance. If there was an international charter on standards along the lines of the 5 points laid out above, NGOs could start to demand that companies adhere to it. For example, a company that entered into an extraction contract, one without competitive bidding, would be censured. Potentially, it is even possible for oil companies to be required to display at their gas stations where the oil used in the gasoline is from. Obviously, oil from different sources gets mixed together, but for the purposes of consumer pressure, the source of oil is a financial concept, not a physical one. If 1,000 barrels of oil from Angola go into a storage tank, 1,000 barrels of the oil that comes out could be designated as being from Angola. If consumers refuse to buy gasoline from Angola, the companies would be reluctant to put it into the storage tanks in the first place. Angolan oil would become harder to sell, except at a discount, and this would create a financial incentive for the Angolan government to be transparent. The same process that so effectively pressured Shell to clean up Brent Spar would be directed to the far more valuable task of making oil revenues effective for development. Consumer pressure works only on those companies that have brand names to protect. Some don't. I have already raised the spectre of the Chinese scrambling for natural resources without much concern for governance. Western consumer pressure is not going to cut much ice with the Chinese, and don't hold your breath waiting for Chinese consumer pressure either. This is the argument put forth by at least some of the Western oil companies. Impose standards on them, and all that happens is that the Chinese are let in. Can anything be done about this? I think so. In part, what the Chinese government wants is a place at the top table, recognition by the international community that China is a key country, powerful and important. The deal has to be that with power come a few responsibilities, one of which is adherence to international standards for resource extraction. If Western consumers force the big brand oil companies to adopt international standards, then in turn, the oil companies will pressure their governments, the United States, Britain and France, to come to an arrangement with China. The West has to offer China greater inclusion in power in return for adherence to international standards. It has to be made in China's interests for the bottom billion to develop rather than to fall apart. A Charter for Democracy. Since the fall of the Soviet Union, democracy has spread rapidly across the developing world. Political scientists actually measure it. There is an index called Polity that rates the degree of democracy on a scale from 0 to 10. In the 1980s, the average developing country scored only around 2. Now the average is around 4.5. However, to date, this transition to democracy has been defined overwhelmingly in terms of elections. This has been inevitable. Electoral competition can be introduced with great speed, even in the most unpromising bottom billion conditions, such as Afghanistan. As the prospect of elections moves toward becoming a reality, many individuals and groups have incentives to behave in ways that facilitate their introduction. They form political parties as a means to acquiring power. But remember, elections are not enough. Electoral competition can make things worse, because patronage will often win out over honest politics in the struggle for votes. Recall the survival of the fattest. By contrast, checks and balances take time to introduce, and they are political orphans. Those parties that expect to rule have a direct interest in frustrating their introduction, and the entire political class stands to lose if patronage politics is made infeasible. Elections determine who is in power, but they do not determine how power is used. Because of the different timescales for elections and for checks and balances, the instant democracies must almost inevitably go through a phase in which electoral competition faces few restraints. The real issue is whether this is merely a phase or becomes a permanent feature of the polity, whether these countries get stuck with a parody of democracy. Why have elections spread around the world? Their spread surely demonstrates the power of international influence, especially that of the international media. Being events, elections get intensively reported. Citizens in the developing world have inevitably come to see an election as the defining feature of democratic legitimacy. Not only does international reporting spread a model that local populations follow, but also it enables them to harness the power of international pressure. Many of the banners at political demonstrations are in English, demonstrating that we are part of the intended audience for these protests. Hence, our message matters. But to date, the message has been concerned nearly exclusively with elections. Checks and balances are continuous and complex. They are not events, and so they have been much less newsworthy. The mature democracies now need to use our evident influence to encourage the less visible aspects of democracy. Since growth itself gradually increases income to the level at which checks and balances are secured, an improvement in them eventually becomes self-sustaining. An international effort to promote checks and balances would therefore only need to be temporary. The wave of electoral competition that swept the developing world in the 1990s and may now sweep the Middle East thus needs to be complemented by a wave of enthusiasm for political restraints. As with resource rents, it would help if there was some international minimum standard, analogous to the minimum standards set out by the European Union. I would start with rules about the media, which are the most effective form of scrutiny. In the societies of the bottom billion, the key media are probably the radio channels and increasingly television. One rare and dramatic story from Peru illustrates this. The government of Alberto Fujimori was notably corrupt, so much so that the chief of the secret police, Vladimiro Montesinos, who was charged with the task of implementing all the corruption, decided to keep careful records. These records now provide a very rare quantitative window on political corruption, and John McMillan of Stanford Business School has analyzed them. His work shows that the Fujimori government set out to systematically undermine each check and balance that restrained it. It bribed members of parliament, judges, newspaper editors, and the staff of radio stations and television stations. If there was a restraint, the government undermined it. The amount it was prepared to pay reflected its view of the importance of each restraint. From our perspective, it is not just creepily fascinating to see a system of bad governance on display, it also tells us what is really important in the fight against it. Where the Fujimori regime put most of its money is probably where we should be most vigilant. While the official constitutional restraints, such as parliament and the courts, were bought, the regime did not spend serious money undermining them. The newspapers were also bought, but it was the same story, thousands of dollars a month, not millions. Where the zeros rolled out on the checks was to buy the television stations. There were 10 stations, and the government bought them at nearly $1 million each per month. This money bought a proper contract. Each day the station had to screen its evening news program in advance for Montesinos and make the required changes. So for the government, it was the television news that was the vital restraint to control. Was this paranoia? No. It turned out that the government was quite right. We know because the government had only bothered to buy the 9 biggest television channels. It decided not to bother with the 10th, a tiny financial satellite service with only 10,000 subscribers. That is how the government fell. Someone leaked a video of Montesinos bribing a judge, and it was broadcast on this one television channel. Protest escalated uncontrollably. So in Peru, the key restraint upon the government was the media, and among the media, it was television. I think that in most bottom billion countries, television is still too limited to be the key medium. It is more likely to be radio. Thus, among the checks and balances, I would place keeping radio out of government monopoly control as vital. Radio stations are sufficiently cheap to establish that, freed from government restraints on entry, there are likely to be too many of them for the government to be able to control them all. Beyond the media, what else? Democracy is designed very differently in different places, so it is pointless trying to set out some grand blueprint that all democracies should follow. There is, however, one other aspect of democracy where international standards would help to curtail massive abuse, and that is how money is raised and spent on election campaigning. I grew up in Britain, which has very strict limits both on how money can be raised and on how it can be spent. I used to be amazed by US-style campaign finance, but that was before I looked around. Even before we get to the bottom billion, campaign spending in the new democracies is amazing. Look at Russia. An election campaign costs around 4 times as much there as it does in the United States, despite Russia's income being only about a tenth of that in America. In relative terms, this is 40 times the US level of spending. And look at Nigeria. Never mind the presidential campaign there. Just to get elected as a senator costs around $500,000. With spending like that, no wonder the politics is corrupt. To raise that sort of money, candidates have to sell their houses, borrow, and beg. And then, if they win, they have just 4 years to recoup their investment. How is money spent during campaigns? Voters are often literally bribed to support a particular party. Transparency International has studied the various types of bribe: money, food, and clothing. All this obviously detracts from choosing candidates on the basis of their performance. There is no ideal way of financing election campaigns, but surely we can all agree that outright bribery of voters is not acceptable. Probably, parliaments should also set some ceilings on contributions and require some transparency in party finances. This is not a very ambitious agenda, but it would at least get the issue of campaign finance started. A charter for budget transparency. How governments spend money is at the core of how they function. At present, spending by the governments of the bottom billion is often atrocious. Remember the survey tracking spending on health clinics in Chad? 99% of the money did not reach its intended destination. It is possible to do something about that sort of failure. Practical measures of scrutiny and accountability can make a big difference. Here is a more encouraging story. The heroes are Emmanuel Tumusiime Mutebile, now governor of the Central Bank of Uganda, but in the mid-1990s, permanent secretary of the Ministry of Finance and Planning, and Ritva Reinicke, a former student of mine. The story begins with Reinicke devising a survey to track public expenditure, the same survey that was done in Chad. She initially devised it for Uganda, where it came up with rather depressing results. Only around 20% of the money that the Ministry of Finance released for primary schools, other than for teachers' salaries, actually reached the schools. In some societies, the government would have tried to suppress information like this, but in Uganda, far from suppressing it, Tumusiime Mutebile used it as a springboard for action. Obviously, one way would have been to tighten the top-down system of audit and scrutiny, but they had already been trying that, and it evidently wasn't working too well. So Tumusiime Mutebile decided to try a completely different approach, scrutiny from the bottom up. Each time the Ministry of Finance released money, it informed the local media, and it also sent a poster to each school setting out what it should be getting. Tumusiime Mutebile is a practical man who wanted to know if things were working. So 3 years later, he repeated the tracking survey. Now, instead of only 20% getting through to the schools, 90% was getting through. In state-of-the-art statistical research that analyzed this experiment in detail, Reinicke and her colleague Jakob Svensson were able to demonstrate that the media had been decisive. In this case, reports in newspapers. So scrutiny turned 20% into 90%, more effective than doubling aid and doubling it again. Not that scrutiny and aid are substitutes. If scrutiny can make spending effective, it then becomes more worthwhile to scale up aid. Tumusiime Mutebile's strategy of publishing budget releases was taken up by Ngozi Okonjo-Iweala when she became Minister of Finance in Nigeria in 2003. One of her first acts was to publish the budget releases to the states month by month. On the first day of publication, newspaper circulation spiked. Citizens wanted to know what was happening to their money. That and the death threats made her realize she was on the right track. So a charter on budget processes could usefully specify scrutiny from the bottom up as well as from the top down. There is a third type of scrutiny that comes sideways, so to speak, comparison with peers. I first came across this as a serious strategy for the bottom billion when it was promoted by a young Nigerian academic, Charles Soludo, who at the time was a lowly consultant to the Economic Commission for Africa, but is now the reformist governor of the Central Bank of Nigeria and has just been voted Governor of the Year. The idea next surfaced in a process known as the African Peer Review Mechanism, whereby African countries volunteer for self-evaluation, modeled on the OECD. It is also useful within countries, as local governments can be compared against each other and ranked. Public agencies hate such rankings because they generate very effective pressure, both from the humiliation within a peer group and from the anger of users. Of course, performance measures can be misleading, but the answer is to make them better. Each of these three directions of scrutiny can operate ex ante and ex post. Ex ante is about authorization for spending, and ex post is about evaluation, such as the tracking surveys. Finally, two very distinct aspects of expenditures need to be scrutinized: their honesty and their efficiency. Reformers usually focus on honesty, but efficiency may be even more important, and its scrutiny requires radically different skills. I think of them as a double hurdle. A charter for budget scrutiny does not need to be sophisticated. It could just spell out these three directions of scrutiny, the two time frames and the two criteria. Introducing scrutiny into the societies of the bottom billion will always take courage, but perhaps the existence of an international charter would lower the threshold a little. A Charter for Post-Conflict Situations. Probably the situation that presents the greatest scope for an international charter pertinent for the bottom billion is the end of a conflict. Think of Afghanistan, Sudan, and Burundi. Recall that although these situations